The new stone unearthed near the Dead Sea Scrolls contained revelations. But what kind of revelations? Up next, Dr. Ken Hansen joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Dr. Ken Hansen, author, lecturer, founder of Treasures in Time, an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the biblical and classical world. And he has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, lived in a politically volatile region of northern Galilee, and taught Hebrew on an Israeli agricultural movement. He has also worked with a television news gathering operation in the war zone in southern Lebanon at the height of the civil war there that left the jewel of the Mediterranean in ruins. Dr. Hansen lends a timeless perspective to the challenges of the future. Here he is, complete show now on Coast to Coast AM. Ken, welcome back.
Good to be with you, George. Warm shalom from the University of Central Florida, Orlando.
Excellent. Now tell me about this new stone unearthed near the Dead Sea.
Just when we think that just about everything that could be found has already been found, we've got something else. And in fact, just within the last year or so, we have a pretty major discovery. If it is in fact authentic, we have a vision attributed to the angel Gabriel written on stone. This is called a Dead Sea Scroll in stone. Most of these scrolls, as we call them, were composed on vellum, parchment material. Mm-hmm. Here is something that is ink on stone, and yet looks like the other Dead Sea Scrolls. We're talking about text that is 2 millennia old and older. This one is particularly striking because it's a message delivered by the angel Gabriel about some mysterious character who will rise from the dead within 3 days. And apparently directed to a rebel leader in ancient Judea known as Simon, but full of the kind of militancy that we also see in the Dead Sea Scrolls, kind of an apocalyptic sensitivity that indeed war is at hand, the end is at hand, that sort of thing. If this is authentic and not a forgery, as we know many such discoveries turn out to be,
then
it has serious implications for Christianity as well. This whole idea of a messianic character who will rise again apparently didn't just come out of the clear blue with Christianity. This was something that was around in ancient Judaism.
If this is authentic, can you date it?
It's hard. That's part of the problem. It has to be done really by the science of paleography, looking at the letters themselves. You can date parchment material. You can date vellum with carbon-14. Of course, even that is being contested now.
Right.
But this is a lot more difficult, and of course it leads to the idea of perhaps a forgery. If a forger is going to create something, then this might be a way to do it. We'll do it on stone instead of vellum material. But still, the contents of it seem to point toward at least 2,000 years ago, this character who was in fact slaughtered by the Romans in the year 4 B.C., is the person that it's addressed to.
Now, when I hear the word forgery, I think that, you know, maybe the guy did it 2 years ago. This is not what you mean, is it?
Well, these days, yeah, forgery can be done like that.
Really?
It's a whole sort of cottage industry going on in the Middle East, and the techniques are really getting pretty sophisticated.
Wow. What's the motive, Ken? They want money for these things?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. These things can be sold. Another example is the famous James ossuary that's purported to be, in fact, the burial chamber, as it were, in stone, of the brother of Jesus, James. And this caused an incredible stir in the archaeological and religious world, of course, until the charges came that this was a fairly recent forgery, in fact. And they have ways that they can even take this material and bury it in the ground and fake a look of age to it, fake what we call patina, which is a residue that will fill into crevices in an inscription, for example. That can even be forged. So it's quite a science, and there's a lot of money behind it, and the jury is still out on the James ossuary. It's generally poo-pooed now in archaeological circles, but I tend to think that there might really be something to it. Hard to know.
Dr. Hansen, I'm fascinated with the study of the Old and New Testaments for several reasons. One, of course, is they're history books, as far as I'm concerned. And if they're proven to be true, whether it's faith-based or not, it's a true testament of what had happened on this planet a very long time ago. Let's take the Old Testament for just a moment. It goes back to Genesis. It talks about fallen angels. Who were the actual authors, the physical authors of the Old Testament?
Numbers of individuals. Everything points to the Old Testament as being not so much mosaic in terms of being composed by one hand, that of Moses, but a mosaic, in other words, pieced together by multiple authors. And even Orthodox Judaism, the most Orthodox brand, will acknowledge that there was an editorial hand. Even if we accept the idea that a Moses-type character received all this on Mount Sinai, there had to be editing that pieced together the composite components of the entire thing we call the Old Testament. Books upon books, not to mention all sorts of books that never made the cut into the Hebrew Bible, as we call it, the Old Testament. So who are the authors? Some of them are noted according to tradition. Others are completely anonymous to us. We'll never know who they were.
And when were they done? Because the Old Testament was pre-Christ, right? Generally?
Sure.
Okay.
And that's a realm of debate. Now, I'm a professor in the Judaic Studies program here at the University of Central Florida, and this is what we are all over in our courses and teaching our students. I don't like to indoctrinate anybody. I always tell my students, I'm not here to indoctrinate you, but I'm here to put out the various ideas, the various theories, let you decide. When it comes to the dating of this, you can go to a very traditional date and date it way old, to 1000 B.C., even 1500, if you think that's when the Exodus occurred, B.C. There are other scholars, more radical ones, revisionist scholars, who will date it in the first few centuries, the Hellenistic period, first few centuries B.C., as late as 400, 300 B.C., that, okay, I tend not to buy, but granted, the theories are all over the place.
It is truly remarkable. And so the Old Testament, they were found exactly where?
The books of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Up until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Back in the 40s, right?
Right. The oldest copies of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible we call it, were medieval. The oldest, more or less complete text is called the Aleppo Codex, found in a town in Syria, dating to the late 900s of the Common Era. It is now residing in the Shrine of the Book Museum in Jerusalem. I was just there last summer, as a matter of fact, and staring afresh at the Aleppo Codex. Quite a story behind that. But it was medieval. That was as far back as we could trace the text of our Hebrew Bible until, as you mentioned, the 1940s, when a Bedouin shepherd lad, the story goes, looking for a lost goat along the western shore of the Dead Sea, stumbled into a cave, came upon the first of this series of parchments. He didn't know what they were. No idea. This very old leathery type parchments, vellum material, we call it. It was the first of a treasure trove that now dates the Hebrew Bible back 1,000 years older than the previous oldest text of the Hebrew Bible. No longer medieval, but we're talking into the ancient period, the first 2 centuries B.C., and we have at least fragments from each and every book of the Hebrew Bible now in the Dead Sea Scrolls, with the exception of the book of Esther. It's the only one that we don't have at least fragments of, but Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, on and on it goes.
Had the Dead Sea Scrolls not been found, what would that have done to all of this?
The entire biblical landscape has drastically changed, as well as our understanding of the whole essence of Western thought and culture, the great three cultures that dominate the Western half of the planet, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. We can trace their roots back in some ingenious ways, and I believe via the Dead Sea Scrolls. It has completely opened a window on perhaps the most seminal period in certainly Western human history.
And you believe, Ken, that many ancient books were deliberately excluded from the Old and New Testaments. How come?
Well, I think you briefly alluded to the concept of, for example, encounters, let's put it that way,
yeah,
with beings from beyond our world. You may call them extraterrestrial. I'll call them non-terrestrial.
Okay.
Okay. We'll use a neutral term because extraterrestrial, let's face it, is pretty loaded. And of course, in the scholarly world, that sort of thing, for some strange reason, is frowned upon. Can you imagine? Scholars don't like to talk about such subjects. But okay, we'll talk about it.
We will.
Yeah.
Yes, we will.
There are multiple allusions. You mentioned one in Genesis, the passage about the Nephilim, as they're called, who apparently came down, visited this planet, and spawned, according to these banned books, a whole race of beings having cohabited with Earth women. There's only a brief reference to it in the book of Genesis, Genesis 6:4, which says that the Nephilim, Nephilim Hayuba'aretz, that's the original Hebrew, the Nephilim, whoever they were in the land, in the earth, in those days. And afterward, when the sons of God, the Hebrew says, B'nei Elohim, went to the daughters of men and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. And then the text just moves on.
And yeah, a very short passage. And it makes you wonder, what's this mean?
Sure. It's begging for a backstory. And one thing we can say about biblical literature is it seems to be deliberately written like this, that it is sparse. It doesn't mince words. It wants the reader to jump into the text and supply things. Or I'm sure in antiquity they would hear it recited, and then they would sit around the campfire and they would ask questions, and what does it mean, and how do we interact with this story? In a way, it's kind of a very modernist approach to literature, because rather than telling you everything you're supposed to know, it demands the reader to get in there and interact with it, and hence all the backstories, entire books that expound on all this stuff to explain what's it doing in Genesis, but for some reason the sages and the keepers of the religious canon just weren't too comfortable with all that speculation, so they systematically excluded it from what we call our Bible today.
Do we have the ability to find out exactly what might be in those excluded texts?
Well, a lot of these have come down to us over the centuries in translation. The original Semitic versions were systematically discarded, banned, as it were. I was pleased to take part in a whole History Channel documentary called Banned from the Bible. Those texts, most of them have come down, but in translation. They were translated to Greek and Slavonic and Ethiopic and multiple other languages. Then the originals were lost, and the scholarly world wondered how many of these had been doctored down through the centuries, how many of them were authentic, when they were composed, who composed them. Well, numbers of them have, in fact, surfaced now, at least in fragments, in, can you imagine, the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing stuff. We have, for example, the book of First Enoch, at least in fragments, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. The book of Jubilees, very important, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Fragments from what looks like a series of these books called the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Tobit, the letter of Jeremiah, the book of Jesus ben Sirah, all represented, at least in fragments, among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this work continues to go on. In fact, only recently there are new efforts at preservation among the thousands of Dead Sea Scroll fragments that still have yet to be fully analyzed and pieced together. This is the world's biggest jigsaw puzzle.
What do you think it means about these non-terrestrials, as you call them? Who are they? What are they?
Yeah, well, these texts, along with the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves, are full of what we call apocalypticism, an apocalyptic mentality. the end is near. They're also very mystical. They're messianic. And whoever these people were that wrote them, and there's great debate about who the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls were. Forget about who wrote the Bible. Who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls? There's no consensus about that either. But whoever these people were, they had a sense that the universe is really, the only way I can put it, is dense with intelligence. Just dense with intelligence, with what they perceive as intermediaries and mediators and ideas that are really foreign to Jewish monotheism down to this day. Again, I teach in Judaic studies, and I can assert just how monotheistic Judaism is to this day. There isn't any place in the religion for multiple intermediaries. There is one God, and that is the heart and soul of it. So even to speculate about, you know, angels and these strange Nephilim is a little bit dangerous in the traditional Orthodox Jewish mind down to this day. And to be honest, it's actually less dangerous to speculate about the non-terrestrial being potential here than it is just to call them angels.
It's pretty safe to say that some creatures, call them angels, call them non-terrestrials, call them ETs, something visited this planet a long, long time ago. Is that pretty accurate?
That's what these people believed. And as scholars, we can't get inside their minds. We can't ask them, what exactly did you see? But we can say that there had to have been an enormous fund of folklore that recorded such visitations. I like the idea of Jacques Vallée and his multidimensional visitation hypothesis. Even he is looking at the idea of religious experience being interrelated, and whether you call it the ET phenomenon or some angelic religious phenomenon, when a person enters into a deep meditative state of consciousness, it seems to open up various dimensions of reality. And from my perspective, it's really tragic that scholarship gets so compartmentalized, especially today. And we've got literary researchers galore, biblical scholars galore, who never even talk with experts on the mind, on psychic phenomena, for example. It's like verboten. You don't know there. Just words on page. That's all it is. And I think we're missing something. We need to be a lot more, talk about multidimensional in our scholarship.
Yeah. Is it possible, Ken, that the authors of these old works just merely made up these stories? They were great novelists of their time. Could they have just done that?
Well, anything's possible. And I'm sure a lot of detractors are going to say, yeah, these were just fantasized. They were novelists, etc. But what Jacques Vallée and others have done is noted the frequency of similar types of stories, of themes, of archetypes that seem to course through these works in the Jewish world and also in surrounding cultures. I'm drawn to one Dead Sea Scroll in particular that was found up on top of Masada that has the most chilling description of some kind of craft, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you have to tell us this one.
Oh, yeah. As well as non-terrestrial beings. It's called the Song of Sabbath Sacrifices, and it was found, of all places, on top of a rocky precipice in the Judean desert. I've been there many times. I've lived in the land. It's called Masada, or Matsada in Hebrew. This was the stronghold of the anti-Roman rebels.
They held themselves up there for days, didn't they?
Months, in fact. And, when the Romans finally battered down the walls, they were greeted by a stony silence, and all 960 freedom fighters, we're told by Josephus, had slain each other by slitting each other's throats, and the last person falling on his own sword, just a grisly thing, because they refused to surrender the Romans. And this rock, this place called Matsada, lay unexcavated for the better part of 2,000 years, was not excavated until the 1960s, when the great Israeli archaeologist Yigael Yadin took a crew up there and painstakingly sorted through all of this. And in the rubble of one of the walls...
Just hold that right there. Perfect time to break, Ken. We're going to come right back in just a moment. And we're back with Dr. Ken Henson, riveting. Okay, Ken, so we go to Masada, and there's some kind of a large rock or something. I'll let you pick it up from there.
It's being excavated in the 1960s by the great Israeli archaeologist Yigael Yadin, and he's got a team up there. They have uncovered an ancient synagogue, one of the oldest synagogues in the world. It's right next to the retaining wall on the outside of the rocky precipice. This place was impregnable. It took the Romans 7 months to build an earthen ramp all the way up the side of the cliff, which they did using Jewish slaves, by the way, from the great revolt of the first century. They got to the very top with their battering ram and knocked down the walls, but part of that wall still stands. And as Yadin was excavating the rubble of the wall, he came upon the remains of parchment fragment, ancient parchment, the same type of vellum material we were talking about.
Like the Dead Sea Scrolls.
It was a fragment of a Dead Sea Scroll, which was astonishing because these scrolls were found way up the shore of the Dead Sea. It must be 30 miles up the shore of the Dead Sea.
Uh-huh.
Is a place called Qumran, where the bulk of this material was found. What is a mangled fragment, half disintegrated, down at Masada? Why, Masada was supposed to have been inhabited by a group of anti-Roman zealots, and the folks who lived up at Qumran, where the scrolls were written, were supposed to be, according to the dominant theory, Essenes.
The Essenes, right.
Who were peace-loving, kind of monastic order. Here we've got a fragment of one of their Dead Sea Scrolls, and we know it was one of theirs because an identical fragment was found in the ruins of Qumran further north along the Dead Sea. And not only is it a Dead Sea Scroll, but it is a non-biblical scroll, one of those that never made it into our Bibles. And it's mystical as well. It's called the Song of Sabbath Sacrifice.
What does it tell us?
And it describes in detail a procession of non-terrestrial beings, let's call them angels, who are going up, ascending from the earthly temple into the heavenly temple. The idea was that everything down here is a copy of something out there in the eternal realm. And this text reads about them soaring aloft, and this murmur of their voices is heard, and they're lifting their wings, accompanied by this clamor and a murmur of angels that calls them, blessing the chariot-like throne above the firmament of the cherubim. Now, I have the original Hebrew here in front of me, and this term that gets translated in English as chariot-like throne is the word in Hebrew Merkava, which is a very loaded word. Merkava, we translate as chariot, but it's a whole stream of ancient Jewish mysticism, and it relates to the concept of God or the divine sitting on top of some mobile object. Literally, the root means to ride upon. God is elsewhere described as riding upon the clouds.
Jeez.
Merkava is a chariot. And the same term seems to be described in the book of Ezekiel, when the heavens are open. And a lot of people, of course, talk about the book of Ezekiel
mm-hmm.
in terms of non-terrestrial encounters. Well, we've got that exact term now, even developed more than we find in Ezekiel, as these beings are ascending. Cherubim, they're called in the Hebrew, while they themselves from below the place where the glory dwells go acclaiming in joyous song the splendor of the radiant expanse. And wherever the wheels of the chariot are in motion, the angels of sanctification dart to and fro all around it, between its glorious wheels. It says they're like fiery apparitions, most holy spirits looking like streams of fire in the likeness of burnished metal or of lustrous ware. This is astounding stuff.
Oh, it really is. I mean, it's almost like they're describing I'll say, extraterrestrial craft of some type.
Well, you can take it that way. And while, of course, the scholarly world is reticent to go there, you don't want to touch
They won't even get close to that.
No. We'll just stick with the words on the page, and it can be really frustrating because, you know, whatever it is, it's important, I think, to try to connect the dots and try to communicate with others who have a little bit more knowledge, perhaps, than just literary theorists about the science of the mind and what the mind experiences. We can't interview these people, and nobody in this text says, I saw this. You know, maybe it's just some kind of archetype, as I call it, some kind of repetitious theme about beings that maybe inhabit space-time with us, or maybe they're beyond space-time. You know, who knows what they are? But this is opening a window on a realm that has, I think, been closed for way too long. They're clothed in luminous garments, an array of wondrous colors, and diffused with brightness, live angelic spirits constantly coming and going beside this wonderful Merkava or chariot. By the way, the term Merkava is used in modern Israel. Same Hebrew is spoken today as thousands of years ago. The word today means tank. It's an army tank that is manufactured by the state of Israel. So when you see Merkava, you get a sense of some craft of some kind that's pretty serious.
Well, when you look at also the work of someone like Zechariah Sitchin, Ken, who interprets Sumerian texts, and his story is 400,000 years ago, beings came down from another planet called Nibiru, which is in our solar system, he says. And again, they came down here, they genetically altered us. What's fascinating about this is no matter where you are on the scope of things on this planet, there are pieces of the same story everywhere.
Yeah, and when you look at other literatures, this stuff was not produced in a vacuum. I'm always telling my students that. And when we read the Bible, the worst mistake we can make is to read it as if it's the only piece of literature ever composed. You know, we don't read the Constitution of the United States that way. You know, you look at the founding fathers, what Jefferson, what Madison wrote elsewhere. You know, you got to look at what else is going on in this other literature. Look at the Samaritan texts. We've got multitudes of them. Look at these banned books. And here is a text that we didn't even know this existed until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, I mentioned earlier that a lot of these banned books, we actually had copies of them that were translated into different languages and had survived down through the ages. But here's one that didn't survive. We didn't know this existed, an unknown book until the middle of the 20th century, an identical copy, as I mentioned, found in those caves at Qumran. And here's where the story takes yet another twist, because there are some, perhaps 50 to 100,000 of these fragments, just like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, that we still have not completely assembled.
Oh my, but we have them.
They exist, but they were stuck together rudely by the original scholars with scotch tape, literally trying to tape them on to their pieces of glass, for example, so they could stare at them better. And this is just when they were beginning to develop scotch tape, by the way. And it probably wasn't too good an idea to use scotch tape.
It was probably thick and ruined it.
Yeah. So oddly enough and ironically enough, the work of the preservationists did more damage to the scrolls than the ravages of time did. But in any case, we've got serious efforts now to remove the scotch tape and to try to somehow restore these fragments as best as possible, and even to get them digitized and out there. There's even a plan to get these things on the internet so that all of us can have access to try to manipulate and use digital techniques to bring out some of the writing, piece them together, which will be a huge boon to us, because when you have a scrap here and a scrap there, obviously they're not going to mean much unless you can fit them properly together and basically create whole new texts. But there's yet another twist. Because a number of these texts, I should say actually the great majority of them, ended up at an East Jerusalem museum called the Rockefeller, where they languished under lock and key.
The Rockefeller
Museum for 40 years. It was sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation. Just a select committee of scholars had access to this material, and nobody else, which is kind of curious.
So the secrets they must have. Huh?
Yeah. And there was all kind of speculation for 4 decades. What are you hiding in there? Why won't you let the rest of the scholarly community have access to this stuff in the basement of the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem? Now, bear in mind, East Jerusalem was Jordanian-controlled. The city was divided from the foundation of the modern state of Israel right until 1967. The Six-Day War was fought, and the state of Israel conquered East Jerusalem. With it, the Rockefeller Museum fell into Israel's hands. Now Israel has control of these thousands and thousands of fragments. Well, guess what? Now, as part of the quote-unquote peace process, the state of Jordan, as well as the Palestinian Authority, has demanded that Israel return the Dead Sea Scrolls as part of the peace negotiation.
Why do they want them?
Well, I guess the money, the fame, the
prestige,
the heritage,
everything,
the
yeah.
prestige, and just basically to stick it to Israel again. And it came to a head just within the last couple of months here, because numbers of these fragments, originally from the Rockefeller Museum, have been on tour in Canada. In Toronto, just now moved to Milwaukee. They're there right now in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
But while they were in Canada, Jordan demanded that the Canadian government seize the Dead Sea Scrolls and cede them to Jordan. So now we got an international controversy brewing, as well as all the other political stuff.
Security
going on.
Must be incredible there.
And to me, the great irony is that the Dead Sea Scrolls are so apocalyptic. They predict apocalyptic war, and ironically enough, the same scrolls might help bring on apocalyptic war.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point indeed. Can we assume, I'm going to try to hold you down on this one, can we assume that this planet was visited by somebody, some creature, some entities from beyond this planet?
As a scholar, I'm not supposed to weigh in. But I can tell you what the authors of the text thought. And they clearly produce these archetypes. They're all over the place. Call them angels, call them what you like. Again, Judaism has a hard time putting any emphasis at all on angels, lest it somehow fracture monotheism
yeah.
and you end up with polytheism. So to that extent, again, it's probably easier to say these are some kind of non-terrestrial beings than to turn them into angelic intermediaries between humanity and God. They were convinced of this sort of thing. And this literature is, especially in the first few centuries B.C., right through the first century A.D., we have scores of these banned books that seem to focus on this sort of thing. And those were precisely the ones that got banned, and that's undoubtedly why. Even the book of Daniel appears to have made it into the Bible just by the skin of its teeth, because we have our hero Daniel having these encounters with someone, something, some non-terrestrial beings, and being shown the end and the way that history is going to pan out. But we have books like the Testament of Abraham, for example, where the great patriarch of Abraham is taken up into the heavens and given a whole tour of the celestial realm. And it's like some kind of either out-of-body experience or NDE or just some psychic phenomenon, and it's hard to say exactly what it is, because we don't know. We can't interview these people. And maybe there are beings that are beyond space-time, again, as Jacques Vallée seems to think.
Given as much as we don't want to knock religion, so they could be angels, but I don't know. To me, Ken, it sounds like we had some kind of E.T. visitation here, something physical.
I hear you.
Yeah. Does not negate
the belief. Scholar in me has to always equivocate, but I hear what you're saying. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't negate a god. I mean, somebody had to make them. You know?
Well, and again, if you are a monotheist, there isn't room for others. There's only one deity. There's only one god.
Yeah.
So it's less dangerous on a at least Judaic monotheistic level to talk about non-terrestrials than it is to talk about all these angelic intermediaries. That's what'll get you in trouble.
Absolutely. We're going to talk next hour about some NDEs and the tie-in with 2012 as well. Would you have liked to have lived during that period as a witness?
Yes, and also no, I'd be terrified because it was the most not only fascinating time, which I talk about perhaps in human history, but the most dangerous, certainly the most cataclysmic. There was enough going on then that would scare the living daylights out of you just to read about it in terms of the cataclysm. They believed that they were in the very end of days. The early Christian community was convinced that they were in the very end of days, and they acted on it, in fact. And that fact probably saved them in the end from sheer and certain extinction.
What's your take of the book of Revelation, Ken? Are you a believer in that?
I believe that it's a historical record. As you pointed out, these biblical texts, isn't it awesome to look at them as historical records?
Yes.
And I've written a new book, in fact, where I show how the early Judeo-Christian movement in the East, not to be confused with the Christianity that ultimately moved west and became part of the Roman Church. There was an entire branch of Christianity we never even heard of, most of us, that flourished in Jerusalem, in Judea, in the land of Israel, in Jordan, that took these things seriously. And my take on the book of Revelation is that it is specific warnings to this group to get out of the land of Israel, especially the city of Jerusalem, which was about to face its most horrific catastrophe in all of history, that sadly most moderns don't even know happened in the first century, a horrific war that left more than a million Judeans, a million plus, dead by the sword and famine, starvation, crucifixion. It was horrific. And we have specific historical clues in the book of Revelation that detail this war with Rome in horrific point by point.
Could that have been the apocalypse as far as they were concerned?
That was the apocalypse,
yeah,
as far as they were concerned. And we know where they went. We know exactly where they fled, where they ended up living, and we know that they persisted for centuries in the East as sort of an alternate Christianity.
I think a lot of civilizations all go through their own apocalyptic events.
Well, sure. And that's okay, because even though, obviously, this was not the end of the world in the first century, it's a good thing that they interpreted it that way. It's a good thing for them that they did. And we have cycles of this sort of thing.
Absolutely.
In our own day as well. I mean, we can find things that sure make it look like the end is near.
Ken, give us your website.
TreasuresInTime.org. TreasuresInTime.org. There's a ton of material on my website.
Can you imagine what it was like for that little shepherd boy to find those Dead Sea Scrolls and not even know what he was looking at?
Can you imagine? He had no idea. Except he was, frankly, a little bit terrified because he didn't know what he had found. He thought that this cave might be a habitation of desert ghosts and goblins, and he ran away in terror. And little did he know what he was beginning, the saga that would unfold.
It's truly amazing. Truly amazing. And who knows what they will find?
Well, yeah, precisely. As I started out our discussion, just when we think we've found it all, it's getting a little bit boring. Here comes something new, like the tablet, the Gabriel revelation. Who would have thought?
I want to talk about that when we come back as well, this Gabriel revelation, and whether you indeed believe it was angelic or, again, if it was this non-terrestrial. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Our special guest tonight is Dr. Ken Hansen. Absolutely riveting, riveting material. Ken, throughout the history of mankind, we have always dabbled with the thought of what happens when we die. These texts, what do they say, if anything, about NDEs, near-death experiences?
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, it's like giving us a backstory to what the Bible itself tells us, which is, as I mentioned, pretty sparse. It doesn't mince words in terms of a text. The Bible just gives us a running story and then moves on. But then you wonder, what about some of the other experiences these biblical characters must have had? What was it like when they died, for example? And we've got multiple such stories from Adam, for example, who is on his deathbed, as it were, facing his own demise, and he sends his son Seth to go back to the Garden of Eden, which they had been expelled from, in order to take some anointing oil from the tree of life and bring it to him to soothe his wounds. These kind of stories just never made the cut of the Bible, and yet they convey to us the most remarkable compassion, even in death, as if to tell us that without pain and suffering and even death, we wouldn't be fully human. So rather than to wince from pain and to recoil from the idea of death, this is something that ultimately we should welcome. But beyond that, we've got some very curious experiences from the stories about the patriarchs. Abraham, that I mentioned earlier, who is taken up into the heavens. And here you have sort of a combination NDE and ET experience. Again, that's why I like this concept of archetypes, where whatever these experiences are, they seem to be fused together. He's brought up and given a preview of what the next life will be. And it's not the only one. We've got the testament of Isaac. That's Abraham's son. And he's told by the angel again. It's an angel, Michael, about his approaching death. And he goes up into the heavens. And he has an experience of a life after this life. It's remarkably like a lot of the near-death experiences that we see today.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And even more remarkable from my standpoint as a literary scholar is that these people are changed by it. When you talk to people today who have an NDE, invariably, it's not just the experience that's remarkable. It does something to them. They have no fear of death. They're changed individuals. And it invariably, they say, I wish I didn't have to come back. But Isaac, for example, he comes back with basically a series of admonitions, sort of a living will that he passes on to his own family on how you should live well. This has changed him. Don't kill with the sword, he tells them. Don't kill with the tongue. Watch what you say. Don't be angry after sunset. Don't accept too much praise. Don't rejoice at your enemy's downfall. And, oh, yes, he prophesies the Messiah.
Now, let's get back to the, if we can, the revelations from the angel Gabriel, if it was an angel, of course. What did they say?
Yeah, I so love talking about this new Gabriel revelation and the tablet. Again, some claim that it's a forgery because, after all, it's written on stone and not on parchment. But we have to be careful about becoming too skeptical in the scholarly community, and I think that often destroys some of the inherent curiosity that we have. When we read here about an apocalyptic vision of the archangel Gabriel, Gavriel is the Hebrew word that means a mighty one of God, and Gabriel is communicating, if this thing is not a forgery, some remarkable concepts and ideas, because it is clearly referencing a period B.C., right, before Jesus was born even, and yet it's talking about some character who will die. And then it says in the Hebrew from this tablet, Leshloshet Yamim Chaye, in 3 days live again.
That is amazing.
And this is B.C., if this thing is not a forgery.
All right. Yet the Jewish faith today and has historically disallowed the fact that Jesus was Messiah and that he rose from the dead.
Well, yes, but my new book actually addresses a lot of these fine points. It's been assumed by most scholars and certainly most Christian scholars for the last couple of millennia that these ideas were not common to the Jewish faith, that they were really unique and unique in history and right. certainly unique to Christianity. If things like the Gabriel tablet are true and they're not forgeries, then we know that these ideas were not just the domain of a new religion that developed. These were right in the heart and soul and bosom of ancient Judaism itself. And as a scholar, I'm fascinated. Again, I'm a scholar of Judaic studies, and I'm fascinated by early Christianity within the Jewish faith. And I'm convinced that this movement was enormous, and it was thoroughly Jewish, and it even tended to be quite apocalyptic. It was caught up right on the cusp of this catastrophe of revolution against the Roman Empire that I mentioned left more than a million Jews dead in the end. And they were aware, certainly, of what the Dead Sea Scrolls were saying. We've got a Dead Sea Scroll that looks a whole lot like the Book of Revelation, and yet it is written in Hebrew, and it predates the Book of Revelation by at least 100 years. And this is remarkable.
Now, is there any way that those who wrote the Book of Revelation, the Gospel, that they would have known about these other texts?
I'm sure. The more I study this, the more I research this on a scholarly level, the parallels are too uncanny to be just coincidental. There are common themes. We love that word, archetypes, all through this literature that talk in specific terms. Sure, the early Judeo-Christians, we have to call them, had to have been aware of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some even think that there was a direct link with whoever wrote the scrolls and early Christianity. One scholar, a colleague of mine, thinks that the mysterious teacher of righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls was, in fact, the apostle we call James, and that the scrolls do, in fact, represent the face of early Judeo-Christianity.
Now, who wrote the Book of Revelation? Was it John or all of them?
Well, as with everything else, it's highly contended. I think that the Book of Revelation has very early roots, that it did derive
beyond John.
From the, pardon?
Way beyond John, I bet.
Well, from the original disciple called John the Beloved. And that is considered, what can we call it, a very traditional, conservative view among a lot of modern scholars. But I think there's material to support that this is a very early text that this beloved disciple probably communicated this tradition, this material, to somebody else, probably lived in Ephesus, who then set it down ultimately in Greek. So you have a Greek overlay of this very early disciple who knew Jesus personally and who communicated these messages, not in Greek. I'm convinced, among a few others, that the original text of the Book of Revelation was Semitic, Hebrew, perhaps Aramaic. These are kindred Semitic languages that then was transmitted into Greek. And if you're dealing now with a Semitic text, you even have a closer link with the Dead Sea Scrolls and their very curious scroll called the War Between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness, apocalyptic Hebrew text of the Dead Sea Scrolls that dovetails with the Book of Revelation and yet predates it.
What do they say or write about evil, the devil? Does that ever come up, Satan?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and yeah, they believe that the universe is dense with intelligence, but that there is a dark side of the force, if you will. If we're going to go to the non-terrestrial type of paradigm, we can think of it that way. It's very Star Wars-ish. In fact, when I teach my students, I always bring in Star Wars analogies. You've got this power in the universe that you can tap into either for good or for evil. And sure enough, evil is said to abound. They saw it in the Roman Empire, and they were wary enough to communicate hidden messages. And in the Book of Revelation, we find cryptic messages. It's like a code that actually encourages this Judeo-Christian movement to flee the city, to get out of Jerusalem just at the right time, and I'm convinced to head across the Jordan River to the east, avoiding the flood, and ultimately settling in an ancient site in Jordan called Pella, and we have it in the archaeology today. They succeeded, I'm convinced, and continued to live there for centuries into the Common Era as a Jewish Christian movement. So we have to be careful when we conceive that the Jewish people just rejected Jesus as the Messiah or rejected these ideas of Christianity. They were all Jews, his followers, at least in the East. They were all of them Jews. And these concepts, while not held in Judaism today, were apparently alive and well in the ancient world.
Do the documents specifically talk about Jesus, or do they just allude to him?
They allude to him.
Yeah.
They allude to him. But when you have, for example, in this Gabriel revelation, this messianic language that talks about a Messiah who appears to be a son of Joseph. And that's really curious,
yeah,
because there is a cryptic passage in the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, this is Jewish religious literature read to this day, that talks about the Messiah, son of Joseph, and then just goes on to another topic. And all kinds of speculation is, who is this Messiah, son of Joseph? And, of course, this is Jewish literature. Are we getting Christian here? But perhaps there was a Jewish tradition that there would be a messianic character born to one named Joseph, as we know Jesus was. And then we find this other interesting word in this same Gabriel tablet that I mentioned earlier in our discussion. The word is Merkava, and I'm reading from the Gabriel tablet. This is their Merkava, Merkava. This is that word we translate as chariot. It was in a Dead Sea Scroll that we read earlier, the Song of Sabbath Sacrifices. Here it is, the same word in this newly discovered Gabriel revelation.
Ken, why can't we take all these texts, the Bible, and find historical references to them physically, such as Noah's Ark up there on Mount Ararat or wherever it is? Why can't we use this as a roadmap to go find these things? If they found Noah's Ark up there on Mount Ararat, wouldn't that tell you that the Bible is accurate? It would to me.
If they found the Ark of the Covenant, for example.
Well, that too.
Sure. Well, there have been attempts, even from the very beginnings of biblical archaeology as a science, which began formally in the 19th century. One great archaeologist, William Foxwell Albright, used to boast that he would take a Bible in one hand and his spade in the other as he would go through the archaeology, and absolutely saw archaeology as confirming details of the biblical text. Now, in more recent years, Albright and his proteges have gotten trounced by more revisionist scholars and archaeologists who are known as minimalists. They're trying to prove that just the opposite, nothing can be substantiated by archaeology, and that nothing in the Bible actually occurred. Almost it's like, if it happened in the Bible, it must not be true.
A storybook.
Sure, and even worse, because this is deliberately contrived to mislead people. But, you know, it's like a pendulum swinging. It goes so far over in that one direction, and now, lo and behold, it's beginning to come back, and there are some staggering things that are coming forth in the archaeology. Only recently, we got another major find where there is an altar that has been discovered archaeologically on Mount Ebal, or Ebal, that Joshua supposedly set up and erected after the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, way back after the Exodus. Well, this story has just been laughed to scorn as total contrivance. Why, this is as historical as tales of King Arthur, is what a lot of modern scholarship has declared. And then out of nowhere, you've got just recently a spectacular find. If this is an actual altar set up by Joshua, this is amazing. Of course, where is the geographical location? It's in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority. And guess what? Now all the geopolitics we were talking about earlier comes into play.
Absolutely. What happens when they decide, whoever they may be, that none of this is real, that it's a great story. Does that destroy religion?
No. No, it doesn't. Now, I think it's relevant whether or not it's real. But
me too.
I know minimalist scholars who absolutely have no problem with it. I could name one, but I better not. He's an Israeli, in fact, who thinks that these are entire contrivances.
All of them.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But he says it doesn't affect my faith at all. When I go to a Passover Seder, it still is very meaningful. These are rich and beautiful stories. It's part of our tradition. And he's happy with that. Well, fine, but we can sit around an archaeological discussion group and really haggle out what's at stake here. And there is a lot at stake. There is really a lot that touches not only faith, but, as I keep mentioning, the modern state of Israel and its very existence, its very survival. If Israel today as a state is to survive, then it needs to be based on something more than just clever contrivances and stories, or why are we here anyway? It means a lot to modern Israelis. I can tell you that the biblical archaeology program at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem today is exploding with students and with applicants, in spite of the fact that it's maybe the most grueling archaeological program on the planet. I mean, you'll be very lucky to get through in a decade. But that's what it's like when you've got another discovery. We've got now possibly the discovery of King David's palace in the old city of Jerusalem. I was just there.
That's last incredible.
Summer,
yeah.
Surveying this ongoing dig now. David even was dismissed as being ahistorical, as being as historical as King Arthur, if he existed at all. And that was what was predominating for the last few decades. And now, whoops,
has the
got his palace.
The entire palace, was it just covered? Was it, I mean, when you said the dig? I mean, how far underground was it?
Well,
covered up.
Yeah, anywhere from 10, 20 feet of rubble has accumulated on all of this stuff
over the years.
Over the years, Jerusalem is one huge archaeological dig, and
built on top of things, didn't they?
Oh, well, sure, sure. And a lot of it, though, again, is in the Arab side. In this case of Jerusalem, Arab East Jerusalem. So in order to dig there, now there is politics involved again, and the Palestinian Authority is not too pleased with this sort of archaeology. But it's a powder keg over there, and the archaeology and the politics, everything combines in uncanny ways. But hugely important. Again, if Israel is to survive as a nation, they have to believe that they just didn't drift through space and suddenly land in where they did. That there's some sort of divine hand and providence, if you will. And here are our texts to prove it, and now here's our archaeology.
Does anybody, though, Ken, ever try to decide? You know, let's assume this is all real. There's a God and everything else, all right? Just for a moment, we'll assume it's real. I believe it's real, but let's assume it's real.
Yeah.
Do they ever question how? How is there a God? How it started? Did the texts ever allude to that? Other than Genesis, that always said, you know, things were made in 7 days. He always was.
Mm-hmm. It's the one presupposition I can say in the Hebrew Bible, anyhow. That is the one thing that is just taken as a given. Everything is debated. Everything is wrestled with. Especially angels, for example.
Yeah, but the existence is a given.
Huh? Of God is taken as a given, and it definitely sets the Israelites apart from any other people. Certainly in the ancient world, they were the only monotheistic faith. And they described, I'll say this additionally, they described God not in terms of what God is, but in terms of what God is not.
Ken, we're going to come back with more. We're going to talk about Atlantis. We're going to talk about 2012 with you on Coast to Coast AM. Ken, is there any kind of link between these banned books and 2012, what we keep hearing about the Mayan calendar end date?
Well, of course, it's intriguing. Everybody's talking about 2012. But what I like is to find parallels between the concepts of the ancient Mayans and the concepts of ancient Judaism and biblical ideas that are especially preserved in what we call Kabbalah, the mystical realm. This whole idea that 2012, rather than being just a terrible cataclysmic end, is really more of, in the Mayan thinking, a paradigm shift. A change in consciousness all over the world. Even some call it a change radically in DNA, that sort of thing. And wouldn't you know that when it comes to Jewish ideas about the end, that's very much the same theme that we get. Even the great prophets, Isaiah, the lion will lay down with the lamb. And these extra-canonical books pick up the same idea. The coming of the Messiah is the greatest paradigm shift of all, when the evil inclination will be taken out of us, as it were, and when nation will not lift up sword against nation, and neither shall they learn war anymore. So I love that as a theme. There is, however, in Jewish mysticism, as well as some of these banned books, the concept of a time of troubles that will come first, before the paradigm shift. Judaism is based on a 6,000-year cycle. And according to traditional Judaism, we are now in the year 5770, moving toward that year 6,000. So even in this Eastern tradition, Judaism, we have the same concept of we're getting toward the end. There will be a paradigm shift, and it will be a glorious time, but there are going to be some bumps along the road and some significant ones before we get there. If we do the calculations, it would still put us 230 years away from the Jewish paradigm shift. So not quite as imminent as 2012, but definitely getting there.
Absolutely. Well, we'll find out. We're getting there closer and closer, aren't we, Ken?
Absolutely. And the thing about the ancients is they had what some people think is unhealthy, but I think is a very healthy idea that the end is imminent. And as much as that can cause people to lose their sanity, in the case of the Judeo-Christian sect in the first century, it saved them. They read the book of Revelation as happening right then and right there. So what's the harm of in every generation thinking, you know, it's time to get ready. It's time to get ready for some shift in paradigm that's going to take place for good or for bad. We need to be constantly vigilant.
These are exciting times right now, Ken.
Oh, my, yeah.
They really are.
On every level, yeah. I mean, when we look at the existence of the State of Israel today, this was unthinkable a century ago, just unthinkable.
Yeah. Atlantis, what's the connection there?
Well, it's another one of those archetypes that we have in numbers of civilizations. One of our banned Jewish Hebrew books imagines a civilization of what they call the Rechabites, who were kind of an idyllic, Edenic civilization who lived on an island far across the sea in sort of a paradise situation that I find very curious as sort of an archetype again. That's one angle we can look at it, but there's another angle that I find even more curious, and that links up with you talk about history, Bible as history, with the biblical Exodus. And it seems to me quite possible, even likely, that the plagues described in the book of Exodus are directly linked with the destruction and sinking of Atlantis. And this is mind-blowing.
It really is.
But it is really, really compelling. We know of an incredible volcanic eruption in the heart of the Mediterranean Sea that took place around somewhere between 1600 and 1500 BC. It was the greatest volcanic eruption on the planet in the last 10,000 years, 10 times the size of Krakatoa, that would have produced tsunamis of unbelievable magnitude that would have inundated the entire Nile Delta. As a matter of fact, we even have volcanic pumice discovered in, of all places, the Delta region of Egypt. And that pumice came from this explosion.
Jeez.
from the island of Santorini in the Mediterranean. I've been there a number of times. The archaeology is also amazing. Unfortunately, there was a cave-in, and recently it's not been open to the public, but hoping that will change here shortly. But I have been fortunate to walk through the excavated streets. The excavations began in the 1950s. And this is the Pompeii of the Mediterranean. Everything intact, exactly the way it was at the time of the explosion, except this explosion took place 1600 to 1500 years B.C. This was an ancient Cycladic civilization of really astounding sophistication, given its date and its time. And I find the link with the Exodus just compelling. What it would have produced in terms of plagues and the sky darkening and inundation that might have drowned Pharaoh's armies. Well, once again, scholars kind of hesitate to go there because, you know, you don't want to get too adventurous in your scholarship. For some unusual reason, I think it just squelches our whole creative sense when the scholarly community does that. What I'm doing is I'm an onboard lecturer on a Mediterranean cruise coming up in May that will go all across this region from Dubai to Jordan to Egypt and on to Athens. And I'll be lecturing on this cruise about the whole Santorini and Atlantis connection.
That is amazing, too. I mean, it just points out, again, how historical these books are.
Well, yeah. I mean, if this was not connected with the biblical Exodus, then it would have produced plagues that sure remind us of the biblical Exodus, that certainly would have been in the memory of whoever it was that wrote down the biblical Exodus. We can't ignore that.
No, not at all. Not at all. Do you ever get into the Gospel of Judas, that gospel apparently that was supposed to be between conversations between Judas and Jesus?
As a matter of fact, I was interviewed for the History Channel about the Gospel of Judas. Sure. That's another fairly recent find now that has...
Authentic, do you think?
Yeah, I do. I think it's authentic, absolutely. This is not from the land of Israel. It was among the cache of texts discovered in Egypt, a whole group of texts, the Nag Hammadi codices. This one painstakingly pieced together over years and years and finally released as a complete text. That's what we have to do, of course, when these things are fragmented so badly. It's the jigsaw puzzle has to be assembled, but once it is, it's a mind blower. It basically rewrites the relationship between Jesus and Judas.
It was a little nicer and pleasant than we were led to believe, isn't it?
In the sense that Judas is depicted as one who ultimately had to do what he did. The idea is that our true being, our spiritual being, needs to be released. And even in the case of Jesus of Nazareth, let's call him a messianic figure in the Jewish world. His inner being, his messianism had to be released. Back to our Gabriel revelation on the Hebrew tablet. This was prophesied before Jesus was born, in fact, if we can accept this thing as authentic. He had to die in order for him to become what he became. And Judas was the one who played the integral role. Where would Christianity be without a Judas, as a matter of fact? So this fills in the backstory once again. These texts.
He was a willing participant, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And Jesus communicated this to him, according to the Judas Gospel.
Now, I would assume, if we could picture them talking, Judas probably said, I don't want to do this.
I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
But this is what is to become of me. You know, Jesus is depicted as prophesying his own death, and this is something that even Christian scholars, again, have scoffed at, because, of course, no one could have predicted his own death, not even Jesus of Nazareth.
Were the other apostles, though, let in on this this agreement?
Well, it's right there in the Gospels that the Son of Man must suffer death and rise again. He's predicting
this. No, but I mean, did they know between the deal between Jesus and Judas that, you know, you got to do this for me, Judas?
These were secret conversations between Jesus and Judas, but the other disciples were feeling a bit of jealousy at the closeness between Jesus and Judas at that point. So he's let in on the whole Gnostic, in fact, secrets, the Gnostic mysteries, which is a whole science in itself, the science of Gnosticism that has come to the fore in the last few decades only with the discovery of the Nag Hammadi text. It's a different way of looking at the universe.
That's fascinating, Ken. Indeed. How did you get interested in all this? How did this happen for you?
Yeah, people ask me this. Sheer curiosity, unusually. I was just studying history. I was a history major and had studied a lot of American history, medieval history, the standard fare. But something drew me to the Middle East. Because I really wanted to understand where we come from, who we are as people, certainly who I am as a Western person.
Sure.
And if you want to discover that, well, you've got to go east, young man, go east. Go back to the cradle of civilization. And I was always interested in the biblical world as well, but I was interested as a historian. I did not want to become a theologian. I wanted to have the freedom to draw my own conclusions. So while still an undergraduate in my senior year, I got on a plane and headed toward Jerusalem and found myself enrolling in a little nondescript school for Americans nestled away on Mount Zion and lived there for the next couple of years in the archaeology and studying the history as well as the archaeology, and then the language was maybe the most transformative experience because I recognized that the language spoken in the streets of Jerusalem today hasn't changed significantly since the Bible. And people don't realize that. And here I was now studying a modern language that opened the door to these ancient texts. I enrolled in a language institute and found myself in an international class with Russians and Iranian Jews who had gotten out after the fall of the Shah. And so it was very serious. There's no common language, so they don't mess around. They make you fluent and fast. So in the course of 1 year from knowing none of the language, I became fluent in modern Hebrew and, by virtue of that, ancient Hebrew. And now I was reading the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it changed my life, obviously.
What could happen in the future, the not-too-distant future, that could revolutionize everything you've been studying and everything so many scholars have studied? Is there anything out there?
There's always things out there, but the tantalizing thing is we don't know what it is until it's found. It could be anything. There could be more Dead Sea Scrolls, and we could find something like the Gabriel revelation. There could be more in the physical archaeology, more about David's palace. There could be just from the scrolls themselves, 50 to 100,000 little pieces of Dead Sea Scroll parchment, some of them no bigger than a thumbnail or a postage stamp, with bearing just a word or two or even a few letters, and many of those letters now faded and damaged because of the way the scholars did not take care of them. And to get these things pieced together and to form entire new texts, it could be anything.
What does it tell us about ourselves, about our ability to exist in the future?
Well, we're more than what we know, and I think these banned books are shouting that at us, that we are inherently spiritual beings, that our consciousness is something more than just the body. And you don't have to be religious to come to that conclusion. The consciousness is not the same as the body. We are more than what we know. And that's what brings in this discussion of the non-terrestrial beings and various theories about how all these spiritual experiences are linked with ET experiences and NDE experiences, all on the realm of the consciousness.
You remember the episode where Moses was going through the sea and the Egyptians were chasing them all? And then the sea engulfed the Egyptians. Do you think that happened?
In one way or another, of course, my training always tells me to equivocate, wouldn't you know? I hate that, but that's what we scholars do. I'm of the scholarly community, that part of the scholarly community, that does not think that if it says it in the Bible, it must not be true. I think that if we have a text, and then if we have some independent evidence, and the text seems to fit the evidence, then that seems to substantiate the text. And when we look at the whole story of the Exodus, it follows not only the geography of the land that we know about, but even the military tactics of the ancients are noted in detail. The way that the Israelites arrayed their column with the pillar of fire, for example, that was often used, a pillar of fire, incidentally, was like a signal flare that told the people where to camp. And if you read the story carefully, even the battle tactics will show you how, with the fire between the Israelites and the Egyptians would have been temporarily blinded at night and could not see where the Israelites were going as they made their way across the sea. Little details like that, you would have to be an expert. You do have to be an expert on ancient military tactics to know how the biblical story fits. So these things are endless, and I think compelling evidence that there's history going on here.
Will we ever find the Ark of the Covenant?
Wouldn't that be nice?
It sure would.
wouldn't it be nice? There are many various possibilities, all right? I have a colleague who thinks that it might actually be underneath the Temple Mount, where, again, I was physically last summer rummaging around once again. Unfortunately, there are many caverns down there that, because of the politics involved, the geopolitics, it is just such a powder keg. If you turn a spade in the wrong location, you ignite World War III. So no digging underneath the Temple Mount, sadly. Another possibility is a cave in Jordan. There's another kind of a renegade archaeologist who's been on the trail of the Ark of the Covenant for years based on the Dead Sea Copper Scroll, and honestly believes that it's in one of those caves based on a book, one of the banned books called Second Maccabees, that says that Jeremiah, the prophet, hid it out there on his own flight from the city of Jerusalem.
What's the name of your new book?
Yeah. It's called Blood Kin of Jesus. Isn't that compelling? I'm talking about the family of Jesus, but not the way that the Da Vinci Code does. I trace the brothers of Jesus via his own Jewish mother, Mary, off to the east as a thoroughly Jewish movement that extended for centuries, that actually had conflict with the Roman Catholic Church and ended up getting basically excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church, but that persisted as long as they could in the east in a place called Pella in Transjordan, that fled across the Jordan River during the Great Revolt, that read the Book of Revelation as a historical warning to flee. It's remarkable stuff, and virtually no one's talking about it.
You like what you do. I can tell.
It's not a job.
Yeah,
such a gig when your work is not a job. Yeah, it's passion. It has to be.
I know the feeling. I know the feeling, Ken. We're going to take phone calls with you when we come back. Do you want to do that? And your website, treasuresintime.org,
and there's information up there about the cruise we're taking as well this May.
Okay, great. Stay with us. Dr. Ken Hansen with us. We'll take your phone calls with him when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Dr. Ken Hansen, and we'll take your phone calls. By the way, less than 4 minutes now for the launch of the Space Shuttle Endeavour. We'll let you know when liftoff has occurred, and then we'll get the update with Richard C. Hoagland in just a moment as well. Ken, you ready for some calls?
Sure am, here in Florida, and staring out the window looking for the Endeavour.
You just may see it.
We usually do here.
Well, it's coming then. All right, you're how far away are you from that?
Not 50 miles.
Well, then you should see it. Okay, yeah. I'll let you know. It's coming up. Let's go to Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen. Good morning.
Morning.
It's a real pleasure for me to talk with you today. I've been wanting to share this with people for some time, and this is a perfect way to do this. I noticed that you were talking about spiritual things, and Noah's Ark is very spiritual.
Sure that.
Everybody would like to know where Noah's Ark is. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right.
Okay. On the northeast side of Mount Ararat in Turkey, at 39 degrees, 44 minutes, 10.42 seconds north by 44 degrees, 15 minutes, 53 seconds, 53.06 seconds east. That will give you a centering on approximate location.
Now, how'd you get to this?
I looked for it for 2 years and finally found it.
Through, like, Google? Like that?
Google Earth, yes. So what you'll be seeing, the key places to look is there's a green oval-shaped forest and a couple of landslides that look like somebody took their two fingers and pushed in the side of the mountain. And then there is an area just above that which has like an eyebrow with an eye in it, and a Picasso of Noah's face is the apple of the eyeball.
What do you think of this, Kent Hansen? I'd like to go look at that.
Yeah, so would I. Of course, we look at all of this biblical material with the perspective of other ancient Near East material as well. We ask, are there any parallels? And, of course, when it comes to Noah and the Ark and that whole story, we have a remarkable parallel in the ancient Sumerian story of Gilgamesh, where we've got another ancient character who is also asked, told, directed by some divine presence to build an ark, to build a ship that will save him during a universal flood. So back to our whole concept of paradigms and archetypes, these stories are universal. So on the one hand, we have something that might help confirm our biblical story, but on the other hand, since they appear in so many different cultures, we have to ask ourselves, is there something going on here, even psychically in the mind, that has produced these stories in so many different variations in so many different cultures? Are we looking for one arc, or are we looking for many?
Absolutely. Look out your window in about 45 seconds, Ken. You should see the Endeavor starting to go up.
All right.
If you can do that, you can give us a description.
I'm staring out our window now. I hope I can see east. That's my problem. That's my challenge at the moment.
Absolutely.
Beautiful view over the university.
Is it a clear night out there?
Yeah.
Where you are?
As a matter of fact. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they had some low clouds by the shuttle, but they aren't there yet. So this launch is going to go any minute now. And feel like Walter Cronkite. There we go. The engines are igniting. I don't think you could see that because it's probably still too low. When you see these launches, Ken, I assume it's relatively high, right? You don't see it from liftoff.
No, we don't. No, we have quite a few people who go out to the Cape to do just that, to watch it from liftoff. We have some just spectacular viewing areas all over Central Florida, and I've been among them from time to time. But all we have to do here in Orlando is just step out on our back porch, and we get a pretty decent view.
Well, there it goes. If you can see it, you should be able to see it now.
I've doused the lights in our office. But the whole question is if I can. Yeah, I see it.
See it?
How about that? There it is, right out my office window.
All right, give me a little color commentary,
A big, bright yellow-orange flare, straight up, beautiful night, just at a slight angle.
Can you hear the roar?
No.
You can't hear that.
You cannot hear the roar, but the flare is just spectacular, and always a night launch is the best.
Yeah. But now, does that light up the entire sky out there?
It's unmistakable. If it does not light up the ground, but anybody can, who's in the area, can see this all over the central part of Florida. We just lost it in the cloud now, but that was marvelous.
And there it goes. Okay, and we'll get an update from Richard Hoagland in about 20 minutes or so. All right, back to the calls. Let's go to San Francisco Bay, west of the Rockies. Hi, John, go ahead.
Hi there. I do have a comment on the Merkava. That term has been interpreted differently as rather than simply a chariot, but as separated into three syllables, Merka and Ba, meaning spirit, mind, body, and that it is a hedral vehicle that one can create with an 18-breath meditation. and that nobody will ever teach you the 18th breath, that it is an ancient secret that one can use to develop a light body that you can use to travel the heavens with after death.
Hmm.
That is a teaching right out of Kabbalah. This number 18 is a mystical number, Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah. 18 is Chai. In Hebrew, it means life. It's the numerical significance. So there is much discussion in among the Jewish mystics down through the centuries of entering a meditative state that will open us to the universe beyond and even to the next life. So that's one way to look at Merkava. You can call it perhaps an imaginative way. You can't say this is exactly what it means. And maybe that's part of the beauty of it. You can't say this means this and this means only this. That is one interpretation, and that's the way it is in Judaism. It's really marvelous on that level, because it, as a faith, it doesn't force you what to think or what to believe or give you only one way to look at something. So while, yes, it means chariot, the root means to ride, as is to ride upon the heavens, but sure enough, there's another concept that I think is also valid in terms of a psychic experience.
We've got Mary in Missouri. Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
An interesting show you have. Thank you for having me. I have so many questions that I don't know where to start, but I know there's a lot of people. Well, for one, George, I grew up as Catholic, too. And when we used to have catechism, I had all these questions.
And me too. I just never got the answers.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
I asked the nun, I said, how do we know there's a God? Have you seen him? Why do we have so many different nuns? Why do we have so different priests, you know? So finally she told me one day, you're asking too many questions. And I mean, here I was, wanting to know more, but I'm going to ask the doctor, did the Catholics take different books from the Jewish scriptures, and did the other people, the other Christians also?
In other words, did the Catholics derive the Old Testament straight from the Jewish Bible?
Right. And did the Christians also? Because, what's that, revised King James Bible?
The whole story of how the Bible came down, of course, is pretty complex and a whole science in itself. But the short answer is yes, the Catholics adopted the Hebrew Bible, with the addition of a few of these books that didn't quite make the cuts are to this day in Catholic Bibles, such as the books of Maccabees, were banned from the Hebrew Bible, but they were preserved in the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible that was translated in the first two or three centuries B.C. By Israelites, by Jews in Alexandria for the consumption of the Greeks. So they took the Hebrew Bible, translated it into Greek, and then that, in turn, was adopted by the Catholic Church as the Old Testament.
And so, but you're saying that Mary was excommunicated from the Catholic, is that right?
I'm talking about actually the whole subject of my new book, The Blood Kin of Jesus, that traces the descendants. There were a line of descendants that most people don't even know existed. Like they were basically called the heirs, the physical heirs of the movement Jesus began in the Jewish world. James, Jesus' physical brother, was the first of those heirs of the movement, kind of a counter version of what Paul was doing in the West. But James stayed among the Jews and did this to the East, and then his brother took over from him, and then their sons and grandsons and descendants until there was finally a confrontation in the early 300s between one of these representatives of the heirs, the family line in the East, and Pope Sylvester in Rome. And the Pope essentially, I use the term excommunicated, but basically sent away the representative of Jesus' own family. Maybe he felt threatened. And that was essentially the end of this whole dynastic succession of the Jesus movement among the Jewish people.
What do you see as the consequences now, Ken, for these missing hidden messages?
On what level? Consequences?
Well, I mean, the fact that we, most of us, don't know what they are. They've been hidden away from us. Will there be any consequences?
I think to open up our understanding of who we are, what the universe is like, with the space shuttle going up. I mean, we're explorers by nature. That's what makes us human. That's why I get a little exasperated with the academic world sometimes, because it wants to basically shut us down and shut our minds down, and we're not even to explore other possibilities of what these texts might mean. I think this stuff is opening up to us, and it's for our own enlightenment. The Jewish mysticism is all over this.
Let's go to New Mexico. First-time caller, Britt's there. Hey, Britt.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call. You mentioned earlier about the island of Santorini.
Yes.
Right.
And possibly a connection to Atlantis, or that it might have just been Atlantis. I have been researching and working on a theory for about the last 10, almost 11 years now. Kind of the same thing. It also happens to be my belief that was Atlantis. And I have two questions. One is, have you ever seen or heard any of the hieroglyphs from Egypt about a tall white race, supposedly masters of the sea, coming to visit Egypt?
I have had some brief contact with that sort of thing. Because basically you had a pan-Mediterranean culture that was known by all the cultures in the region, and by the way also linked up with Crete. And the kind of artifacts found on Santorini are virtually identical with kind of pottery that was found on Crete. And
the colors,
civilization,
right,
was known all the way down to Egypt. And yes, some of the hieroglyphs do address them.
And some of the red and black rock and stuff like that that's found on Crete, correct? And the colors and stuff like that?
The colors, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Beautiful. My other.
So it was one pan-Mediterranean cycladic, early, very early civilization, incredibly advanced, and it seems reasonable, at least to me, and some other researchers, that the same cataclysmic phenomenon that destroyed Santorini was ultimately responsible for the end of the Cretan civilization as well.
Correct. And real quick, I know there's other people. I just want to get this out. I have a theory about the demise of that island, the gigantic volcano that happened, coinciding with, and it's kind of far out there, but this is my belief, that it had everything to do with the plagues that went upon Egypt.
Well, there you go. That's exactly what I've referenced. It would have produced cataclysmic plagues on Egypt, and even the part about the waters rushing in and swallowing up Pharaoh's army. Well, that's been dismissed, of course, by scholars. But if anything could have done that, and would have done that, it would have been the kind of tsunami set up by this cataclysm.
Whenever events like that occurred in those days, Ken, did they always attribute them to the gods because they just didn't understand them?
Sure. And who's to say that they were not attributable, in fact?
We probably still do.
Yeah, sure, exactly. When something happens, it's human nature. I'm teaching a course now on the Book of Job that deals exactly with this kind of a phenomenon. Humanly speaking, is that we need to explain. We need to explain things, and ultimately the answer that the Book of Job gives is, hey, look at the universe. We can't understand it all, but when we look at the order that's out there, back to our question about God, that more than anything in the Bible answers the God question, that if there is such an incredible order in the universe that we're exploring even as we speak with our shuttle going up, then even though we don't fully grasp it, there must also be an order spiritually in that realm, even though it's not fully grasped, that we have to accept.
Let's go to Coventry, Ohio. Mike's got us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Mike.
Thanks. Good evening, George and Ken.
Hi.
George, John A. Rush has a book called Failed God, and I think would make for an interesting interview.
Failed God.
Ken,
okay.
On your theme of exploring, a quick comment. Joseph Campbell said religion is a defense against a religious experience. So my question is, please, what do you think of John M. Allegro's book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and his translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls that Jesus was a mushroom fertility cult?
Ooh.
Yeah, that is that theory.
Yeah. Well familiar with John Allegro, who had quite a fine reputation as a scholar until he wrote that book that basically finished him and his reputation. And I think some of that can be prone to exaggeration, and it's just kind of the spectacular kind of headline grabbing stuff that makes great publicity and is not necessarily the best scholarship. But by the same token, I'm a little bit defensive of John Allegro, because he was trying at least to form some conclusions, and I think some of them he was really on some interesting ground with, pointing out the similarity between so many of these Dead Sea Scroll texts and what we find in early Christianity, in the New Testament, and a certain militancy in this movement as well that is often just kind of skirted over. And we kind of think of Christianity as very pacifistic, but wait a second, the Dead Sea Scrolls are not pacifistic at all. And when it comes to the hallucinogens, that's where I'm not so sure. But I do like this idea that when we get into certain states, moderns can get into a certain meditative state, and inhabiting certain mental realms. Remote viewers do this.
All right, Kenny, we got to run. We'll be back with final questions and an update from Richard C. Hoagland. Well, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, has been monitoring the apparent successful launch of Space Shuttle Endeavour. Let's go to Richard. Earth to Richard.
It's a very successful launch. And, you know, it's really a time of bittersweet sadness, because this is the last night launch of a heavy lift launch vehicle that we're going to see from the United States for maybe a generation or a generation and a half if Obama's budget proposal is approved by Congress.
It's gone. It's over.
It's gone.
There's
only four more shuttle flights left. This was the last night launch. I'm watching the replays now on NASA TV. They have many cameras around the launch pad. And each one has a different view, including long, long-range telescopic views. I'm watching one of those telescopic views now. Oh, what an amazing thing this is. I have been lucky enough, George, to actually see a night launch of a huge rocket from the Cape. It was the launch of Apollo 17. I had borrowed a ship called the USS Stottendam from the folks that run that line, and
yeah,
we took a whole bunch of people, including Carl Sagan, and parked it offshore with Isaac Asimov to watch the first night launch and last of a Saturn V going to the moon.
Spectacular. I know.
Absolutely,
I guess
incredible.
Ken Hansen was watching the shuttle go up.
I could hear, he could see it from his office.
That's,
you know,
exciting.
When I do the thing at the LA Expo in a few days, when Robin and I do it, I'm going to be talking about how this cannot stand. This cannot be the way the U.S. manned space effort ends.
No, It's
there are indications of other things going on. So if folks come on down, they will see some things that we don't have time to talk about on the air tonight. But there is other news on this front. This is not the last word, and I don't think this is going to be the last spectacular, because the United States can't end this way. This is not the way we fizzle out on a dream that's been imbued in generations. This is not the way it's going to end.
Reminds me of the skier in the Olympics a few years ago. She was way ahead of the game, turned around to laugh at everybody, and she tripped and didn't get the gold. Remember that?
I certainly do.
That's what's happening to us. Thanks, Richard. Take care of yourself. Richard C. Hoagland, head of the EnterpriseMission.com. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Dr. Ken Hansen right here on Coast to Coast AM. Ken, is your new work, Bloodkin of Jesus, available yet?
Oh, yes, Bloodkin of Jesus. It's out. It's available both in local bookstores and on my website.
Super. Let's go to final phone calls. Here we go. Let's go to Youngstown, Ohio. Stephen, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Stephen.
Hey. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Hansen.
Hi there.
Hey, George, I finally made it. I have to apologize. I got cut off last week. It's my provider.
Oh, no. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I just got a couple of questions for the doctor. I'm not a scholar or nothing like that. I just dabble with history. But when you mentioned a couple things earlier, like the Gnostic Christians and the, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right or not, the Essenes or Essenes.
The Essenes, right.
I know they were strongly tied to Jesus. And I had a little book that I read years ago about the lost years of Jesus, and it mentions stuff like the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi discovery.
Hammadi, right?
Yeah, and that just sparked it right off there, and I'm thinking, I remember reading about this. And well, my question for you is, was he strongly influenced by this sect to the point of where you could say it was practically pre-Christian in thought and, you know, basically what they were? Because they're kind of seems to be a very strong connection there. And the other question I had for you was the Ark of the Covenant. That's it almost sounds way out to the point of where it could be construed as like some type of technology that people of that day and time would not have possessed.
Mm. Okay, well, as far as any connection between Jesus and the Essenes, the scholarly world is very divided, a very hot, incendiary topic. One colleague and friend of mine thinks that there was such a strong connection that, as I mentioned earlier, James, Jesus' brother, he believes was in fact the leader of this group of the Essenes, and that how that matters is that these scrolls are so very apocalyptic and so very militant, it would turn this early Jesus movement really into sort of a revolutionary anti-Roman freedom fighter group that strong. Now, I kind of hesitate on that. I'm sure that Jesus was aware of this sect. I can't prove that he was or was not involved with them, but from just reading the Gospels in a cursory way, it looks as though Jesus doesn't really like some of the attitude of this sect, because yes, he's aware of the threat of Rome. He's aware of oncoming war, in fact, but his attitude is, let's not get involved in this. In fact, and this is in my new book, according to the Gospels, he delivers a message to his followers. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by enemies, flee, flee out, and pray that your flight not be in winter. And Christians down through the ages reading that have been clueless. When you pray your flight not be in winter. What? So you don't get chilly? Is that it? No, because the Jordan River floods in the wintertime.
Ah.
And if you're fleeing from Jerusalem, and we know many people did, they were trying to get out as the Romans came in their juggernaut, and the Romans trapped them on the west side of the Jordan River, cut them to pieces. But we're told by Eusebius and other ancient Christian historians that the Jesus movement in Jerusalem actually went when the river was low, and they got across. They went to Pella in Jordan. So bottom line is, I think Jesus was aware of the apocalypticism of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of the Essenes, but his difference was, we don't want to get involved because we don't want to end up among those freedom fighters dead on the top of Masada.
Good point. Next up, let's go to Anonymous, west of the Rockies. It's your turn. Hey there.
Oh, thank you, George. Sure. Professor Hansen. I had a question for you. Some of these ancient writings might relate to modern-day events, such as Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basis for all of the Anonymous programs, Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, millions of people worldwide. And they claim that it's all based on the teachings of Christ, the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, where they use they do inner inflections to look at the things that cause you to do things rather than just confessing the things that you do and the things you've done. And I'm thinking that with these ancient writings, maybe there's some other correlations that match with the 12-step programs.
Actually, there is one ancient text that physically describes 12 steps. I think it's the Testament of Jacob. Yes, the Testament of Jacob, where he is taken up in sort of a near-death experiences into the heavens, and he witnesses the sufferings of those who have gone wrong. But we read in the Bible about Jacob and the ladder, Jacob's ladder, the famous ladder in the biblical story.
Right.
Well, this particular Testament of Jacob declares that the ladder is this age, and there are 12 steps on it, and the steps are the periods of this age. So who knows? Maybe we found a 12-step program that, and again, all these experiences encourage us how to live better. That the NDE isn't an end in itself. These ancients come back transformed. In this case, here's Jacob with his own 12-step program. Interesting you mentioned it.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Madison, Wisconsin, east of the Rockies. Hey, Will, go ahead.
Good morning.
Hi.
I am an older person, and I grew up with my mother tongue being Finnish. That was just by chance. In any event, I've been intrigued by the Bible, and I went to a Protestant Lutheran college, St. Olaf, Northfield, Minnesota, and my parents had no religion. I had no religion. But I've been intrigued by the Bible, and, I'd like to have a belief that there's a life hereafter. In any event, Mike, I have an interesting question. Is there a possibility that the tongue, the mother tongue of Jesus, was not Indo-European, not Afro-Asiatic, not Aramaic, not Hebrew, that in the Near East, people spoke many different tongues, and the possibility may exist that Jesus' mother language may have been some dialect of Finno-Ugric, and that when he spoke, for example, to Peter, "Thou shalt be called Kephas," Kivi, "for upon this rock the church shall be built," and on the cross, Jesus, the Romans did their best. They tried, and the Greeks, to write down the sounds of the tongue that Jesus spoke. He allegedly, they wrote it down as Elava, Elava, Loime, Savuritan. Elava, Elava, Lama, or Ela, Ela, Lama, Sabachthani, means living, living, we achieved our purpose. That's more or less the word that is done. And it's very interesting because there is a possibility, in fact, that the mother tongues that Jesus spoke, and in fact, God, if he was going to speak to the people there in that region, in their native tongue, for example, in Moses, when God spoke to Moses, Moses asked, "Who are you?" He said, "Ehya, ehya, askaroibi." I am all.
Now, isn't it also true, though, Ken, that after the Tower of Babel situation, that they all spoke different tongues?
Right. But even that is a paradigm for all the languages being linked. And while I disagree with our caller that would have been Jesus' mother tongue, I'm in a minority, by the way. I think it was Hebrew, whereas most scholars think it was Aramaic. What I will say is that multiple languages have these common links to them, and even in the alphabets, there are some incredible charts that have been put together over in Israel that link virtually all of our Indo-European languages together to a common Phoenician root. And it's very clear, even in the alphabets of Phoenician, Hebrew, Greek, Latin. So I think our caller may be onto something in terms of finding some common links, even with some obscure languages that we thought of before. But in terms of what Jesus actually said, for example, on the cross, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, is clear Aramaic, but it linked with the Hebrew Eli Eli lama azavtani in Hebrew. My God, why have you left me? Why have you forsaken me?
He's right,
parroting
right.
What David said.
Why?
And kepha, by the way, is rock in Hebrew and Aramaic. So he's talking to Peter, saying in your Petros, which is the Greek version of kepha or Cephas. So when we get into these languages, yeah, we get incredible insights, and I'm open to all of them.
Will we ever get these hidden books out into the public?
There aren't a lot of books. What we're talking about are the fragments now.
Just pieces.
Pieces. That when we piece them together, we might find, in fact, representatives of some books that we didn't know existed. Some even are mentioned in the Bible. There's one mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Book of Hagoy, apparently. It probably means some book of meditation that the scrolls reference, but we don't have it. So maybe we'll find in these fragments some portion of that and be able to piece more and more of it together. This is painstaking years and years, really a lifetime of labor that's ahead of us. Once this stuff comes online now, and this is the news and really the new developments what we're looking for in the future, then any of us will be able to manipulate digitally these fragments, try to piece them together and use the best digital technology to bring out some of these letters.
Let's go to Toronto International Line, and we'll squeeze you in here. Tom, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, George. Sure. Doctor, I've been in Ethiopia. There is the old language. It's not Ethiopic. It's called Geez. It's G-E-E-Z. They use it in Western literature, but the language is similar to Hebrew, and it's got all the references about the Bible on different things. They have so many books, nobody even got into them. Actually, the Arkaba or Merkab means is a boat or something that connects to other beings. So have you got a chance to go through those books in Ethiopia somehow or any ways?
I have dealt with some of this Egyptian material, absolutely, in writing my book, Secrets from the Lost Bible. And the links are there. There was a huge Jewish community, especially in Alexandria, that translated the Hebrew Bible there in Egypt for the vernacular understanding of the people there. So it's a huge tradition that is woven in and out of the land of Israel itself.
Okay, very good. Time for one or two more. Eugene, Oregon, we go. Go ahead, Mike. You're up with us.
Hi, George. Thanks.
Hi.
Thanks again.
Sure thing.
Professor Hansen, I just had a few quick questions that are you could probably go on forever about, but what is the most accurate scholarly translation of, I guess, what's accepted as biblical?
Ah, that's a good one. Yeah, a real common question, too, and a very good one. And the bottom line is that when we deal with translation, there isn't any real good answer. You can go for an accurate translation, word for word, verbatim, but But if you do that, the translator is going to lose smoothness and oftentimes meaning, because languages are put together differently with different syntaxes and different order, and different expressions mean different things. So the more slavishly accurate you are, the more you lose in terms of just speaking and writing to your audience. The more smooth you try to write, conveying what you think is the best meaning, the more accuracy you're going to lose. And so it's really a matter of picking and choosing among the multiple translations, and there's no good answer. I think that the new King James is as good as any in terms of trying to be very accurate, but trying to smooth out some of the difficulties. Of course, we deal with the Jewish Publication Version here in our program at the university. It goes through the same issues. So translation is a bugaboo, and the best thing to do is, hey, study Hebrew.
Interesting, Ken, the Word of God edited by the hand of man. Huh?
By the hand of man, and we are always at the mercy of the translator. I always tell my students.
Well, that's true. That's dangerous, too, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so multiple translations is another thing that you can do. Even online now, you can get multiple translations laid out side by side. And as I often do with my students, you have to occasionally go back to the original Hebrew, whether your folks understand it all or not. You point out this is what the word is, like Merkava, right? Now here are different ways we can understand that, because no translation is going to help.
The book, Bloodkin of Jesus, available all over the place, right?
Right. And on the website, treasuresintime.org, as well as our amazing Mediterranean cruise.
All right, keep in touch, Ken, all right?
Absolutely.
Especially when late things break archaeologically out there in the Middle East. Love
yeah,
to talk with
do,
you about that.
And they always are.
Okay, appreciate it. Dr. Ken Hansen, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. treasuresintime.org, his latest work is called Bloodkin of Jesus. Fascinating when he was talking about the non-terrestrials. For Jason Bowers, Gina Salvati, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.